So your Communist Party has suspended its Moscow headquarters closed. Leningrad is once more St. Petersburg. Stalingrad is Volgograd. Organized crime has gone viral. Justice is nowhere. Unpaid soldiers returned from the ill-starred Soviet campaign in Afghanistan roam the country and are everywhere for hire. Civil society does not exist, and Yeltsin is unwilling or unable to impose it. All this I knew before I left for Moscow in the summer of 1993. So what possessed me to take my 20-year-old undergraduate son along with me, I'll never know. But come along he did, and happily, and we muddled through without a mishap or a cross word. The purpose of our journey was clear to me, or so I tell myself now. I wanted to get a taste of the new order. Were the new crime bosses the old ones in new clothes? Was the KGB really being disbanded by Yeltsin, or had it been, as so often in the past, merely reconstituted under another name? Whatever grand plans I may or may not have had, nothing could have prepared me for the realities of the Russia we were about to meet head on. In Hamburg, our starting out point, I solemnly set about stocking up with the same essential supplies that I had taken to the Russia of 1987. Giveaway soaps, shampoos, toothpaste, Cadbury's chocolate biscuits, Scotch whiskey, German toys. Yet already, at Sheremetyevo Airport, where we passed through on the nod, there was an air of garish materialism. Perhaps the most improbable to my unready eye, for a deposit of $50, you could rent a cell phone from the kiosk at the exit. As to our hotel, forget the Minsk. This was a glittering, marbled palace with wide, curling staircases, chandeliers big enough to light an opera house, and a bevy of smart, conspicuously unattached girls dawdling in the lobby. Our bedrooms reeked of fresh paint, air purifier, and plumbing. One glance at the shop fronts as we drove through the city had said it all. Gone was the fabled state-run shopping emporium, Gum, and in its place, Estee Lauder. This time, my Russian publisher does not embrace me. He does not joyously whisk a bottle of vodka from his desk drawer and toss the cap into the waste paper basket. First, he eyes me through the peephole in his steel door, unfastens a battery of locks, shuffles me through, and fastens them again. In a low voice, he apologizes for being the only one in the office to greet me. Since the insurance company came, he says, his staff won't come in. Insurance company? Men in suits with briefcases, selling insurance against fire, theft, and flooding, mostly fire. The neighborhood is very high risk following a spate of arson attacks. So the premiums have to be high too, which is only natural. A fire could break out any time. Better sign up straight away. And here's a pen. Because otherwise, certain people they know will firebomb the place. Then what will happen to all those old files and manuscripts we see lying about? And the police, I ask, advise you to pay up and shut up. They're part of the racket. So, will you pay? Maybe. We'll see. He won't give up without a fight. He used to know influential people, but they're not influential anymore. I ask a former KGB friend how I can meet a top mafia chief. He calls me back. Be at the so-and-so nightclub at 1 o'clock on Thursday morning, and Dima will receive you. Your son, bring him along. He'll be welcome. And if he's not a girl, and if he's got a girl, bring her too. That's a different story. It's Dima's nightclub. He owns it. Nice customers, good music, very safe. Our indispensable bodyguard is Pusha, the all-Abkhazia wrestling champion and advisor on all matters relating to his people's struggle for liberation. He is squat and broad as the Michelin man. A polymath, linguist, scholar, and paradoxically the most peaceable fellow you are ever likely to meet. He's also by way of being a national celebrity, which is a kind of protection in itself. Fit young men with submachine guns line the way to the nightclub entrance. While Pushia looks on benignly, they frisk us. Benches of scarlet plush around a circular dance floor. Couples dance sedately to 60s music. Mr. Dima will be with you shortly, the manager informs Pushia as he ushers us to a banquette. Driving us here in his car, Pushia has already provided us with an example of his powers of peaceful intervention. The street is blocked. A small car and a large car are intertwined. The drivers are about to come to blows. An eager crowd is taking sides. Pushia opens his door and strolls over to the belligerents, I assume with the intention of separating or quelling them. Instead, he takes hold of the smaller car by its rear bumper, disentangles it from the larger car, and to the raucous applause of the crowd, parks it single-handedly at the side of the road. We drink our soft drinks. Mr. Dima may be late, the manager warns us. Mr. Dima may have business to attend to. Business being the new Russian catchword for impenetrable transactions. Sounds of circumstance in the corridor alert us to a royal arrival. The music swells in greeting, then stops dead. First to enter are two able young men with close-cropped hair and tight blue-black Italian suits. Spetsnaz, Pushia tells me in a murmur. For Moscow's new rich, former special forces soldiers, are the bodyguard of choice. With bird-like jerks of the head, the two men case the room by sections. Spotting Pushia, they hold the stare. Pushia smiles benignly in return. They take a step backwards, one to each side of the entrance. A pause, then enter, as if by popular demand, Kojak of the New York Police Department, alias Dima, followed by a retinue of pretty girls and more young men. Now, if you've seen the Kojak television series, the comparison is ridiculously apt, right down to the Ray-Ban shades. Shiny bald head, very big shoulders, rolling walk, single-breasted suit, arms lifted ape-style from the sides, a bulbous, clean-shaven face frozen in a half-sneer. Kojak is a big hit in the new Russia just now. Is Dima deliberately styling himself after him? He wouldn't be the first crime boss to think he's the star of his own movie. The front row of the stools is evidently the family pew. Dima sits himself at the center, his people sidle in beside him. To his right, an extremely pretty girl in jewels. To his left, an expressionless, pock-faced man, think conciliary. The nightclub manager brings a tray of soft drinks. Dima abjures alcohol, says Pushia, who abjures it himself. Mr. Dima will speak to you now, please. Pushia sits tight. With my Russian interpreter, I pick my way across the dance floor. Dima extends a hand. I shake it, and it's as soft as my own. I kneel down in front of him on the dance floor. My interpreter kneels beside me. It's hardly the best of postures, but there's no space for us to do anything else. Dima and his people are peering at us over the balustrade. I've been warned that Dima has no language but Russian. I have no Russian. Mr. Dima says, "What do you want?" My interpreter bellows into my right ear. The music is so loud that I haven't heard Dima speak, but my interpreter has, which is what matters, and his mouth is 4 inches from my right ear. Our kneeling position seems to call for a moment of bravado, so I say I would like the music turned down, and would Dima be kind enough to remove his dark glasses, because it's difficult to have a conversation with a pair of blacked-out eyes. Dima orders the music down, then testily removes his dark glasses, leaving his eyes naked and pig-like. He's still waiting to know what I want. Come to think of it, so am I. I understand you're a gangster, I say. Is that correct? I can't know how my interpreter translates this question, but I have a suspicion that he has watered it down because Dima seems remarkably at ease with it. Mr. Dima says, in this country, everyone is a gangster. Everything is rotten. All businessmen are gangsters. All businesses are crime syndicates. Then may I inquire of Mr. Dima what line of business he is actually engaged in? Mr. Dima is engaged in import-export. My interpreter begs me in a don't-go-there voice, but I have nowhere else to go. Please ask him what type of import and export. Just ask him. It's not convenient. All right, then ask him what he's worth. Can we say he's worth $5 million? Reluctantly, my interpreter must have asked the question, or something like it, because Dima's people are sniggering, and Dima has responded with a contemptuous shrug. Never mind. I think I see where I'm heading now. All right, it's 100 million. It's 200. It's whatever. Let's agree that it's pretty easy to make a lot of money in Russia just now. And if things stay as they are, we can assume that in a couple of years, Dima will be a very rich man indeed. Mega rich. Just put that to him, please. It's a simple point. And presumably my interpreter puts it to Dima, because I get a kind of smirk of agreement from the lower part of his bald face. Has Dima got children? I inquire, reckless now. He has. Grandchildren? It is immaterial. Dima has replaced his Ray-Bans, as if to say the conversation is over. But for me it isn't. I've blundered too far down the road to stop now. Here's my point. In the United States, as I'm sure Dima knows, the great robber barons of olden days made their fortunes by what we may call informal methods. I am pleased to detect a flicker of interest from behind the Ray-Bans. But as the robber barons grew older and looked at their children and grandchildren, they got all idealistic and decided they needed to create a brighter, kinder world than the one they had ripped off. The blacked-out eyes remain fixed on me as the interpreter conveys whatever he conveys. So my question of Dima is this. Could he imagine, as he grows older, let's say in 10, 15 years from now, could Dima see a time coming when he might start building hospitals, schools, and art museums as an act of philanthropy? I'm serious. Just ask him. As a way of giving something back to the Russian people. He's, well, robbed, actually. There's a standard joke in old movie comedies where people talk to each other through an interpreter. A question is put. It is interpreted. The person for whom it is intended listens intently, then flings his arms around and narrates for 2 long minutes of movie time. And the interpreter, after a strange pause, says, no. Or yes, or maybe. Dima doesn't fling his arms around. He speaks a measured Russian. The supporters club, they all start to giggle around him. The short-haired sentries at the door, they start giggling. But Dima goes on talking, satisfied at last. He puts his hands together and waits for our interpreter to relay his message. Mr. David, I regret to tell you, Mr. Dima says, fuck off.
Many thanks. And Stephen Cornwall is going to read from The Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
That's a very hard act to follow. But I thought what was interesting, actually, conceptually, was that the thing is read from a book that's about to come out, or come out later this year, and in terms of the relevance we were discussing earlier, to read actually from a book, the very beginning of really the first Macari book that really took off, is by Woman from the Cold, which was written 53 years ago, and just tells you how long Macari has had a voice that we're conscious of. Chapter 1, The Checkpoint. The American handed Dima another cup of coffee and said, Why don't you go back? We can ring you if he shows up. Lima said nothing, just stared through the window and checkpoint among the empty street. She can't wait forever, sir. Maybe he'll come some other time. We can have the police contact the agency. You can be back here in 20 minutes. No, Mr. Demas, it's nearly dark now. But you can't wait forever. It's 9 hours over schedule. If you want to go, go. You've been very good, Demas added. I'll tell Tremmy you've been damn good. But how long will you wait? Until he comes. Demas walked to the observation window and stood between the two motionless policemen. Their binoculars were trained on the eastern checkpoint. He's waiting for dark, Demas muttered. I know he is. This morning you said he'd come across with his workmen. Lima's turned on him. Agents aren't aeroplanes, they don't have schedules. He's blown, he's on the run, he's frightened once after him, now, at this moment. He's only got one chance, let him choose his time. The younger man hesitated, wanting to go, not finding the moment. A bell rang inside the hut. They waited, suddenly alert. A policeman said in German, black Opel record, federal registration. He can't see that far in the dusk, he's guessing, an American whispered. And then he added, I didn't want to know. Shut up, said Lima from the window. One of the policemen left the hut and walked to the sandbag emplacement 2 feet short of the white park demarcation, which lay across the road like the baseline of a tennis court. The other waited until his companion was crouched behind the telescope in the emplacement, then put down his binoculars, took his black helmet from the peg by the door, and carefully adjusted it on his head. Somewhere high above the checkpoint, the arc light sprang to life, casting theatrical beams to the road in front of him. The policeman began his commentary. Lima knew it by heart. Car halts at the first control, only one occupant, one woman, escorted to the Voco hut for document check. They waited in silence. What's he saying? Said the American. Lima didn't reply. Picking up a pair of binoculars, he gazed fixedly towards the German controls. Document check completed, admitted to the second control. Mr. Lima, is this your man? The American insisted. I ought to ring the agency. Wait. Where's the car now? What's it doing? Currency check, customs, Lima snapped. Lima watched the car. There were two Vocos at the driver's door, one doing the talking, the other standing off, waiting. The third was sauntering around the car. He stopped at the boot, then walked back to the driver. He wanted the key. He opened the boot, looked inside, closed it, returned the key, and walked 30 yards up the road to where midway, between the two opposing checkpoints, a solitary East German sentry was standing, a squat, silhouette, in boots and baggy trousers. The two stood together, talking, self-conscious in the glare of the arc light. With a perfunctory gesture, they waved the car on. It reached the two sentries in the middle of the road and stopped again. They walked round the car, stood off, and talked again. Finally, almost unwillingly, they let it continue across the line to the western sector. It is a man you're waiting for, Mr. Lima, asked the American. Yes, it's a man. Pushing up the collar of his jacket, Lima stepped outside into the icy October wind. He remembered the crowd then. Nothing you forgot inside the hut, this group of puzzled faces. People changed, the expressions were the same. It was like the helpless crowd that gathers round in a traffic accident, no one knowing how it happened, whether you should move the body. Smoke or dust rose through the beam of the arc lights, a constant shifting pall between the margins of light. Lima walked over to the car and said to the woman, where is he? They came for him, he ran, he took the bicycle. They couldn't have known about me. Where did he go? We had a room near Brandenburg over a pub. He kept a few things there, money, papers, I think. He'll have gone there. Then he'll come over. Tonight. He said he would come tonight. The others have all been caught. Paul, Derek, Lanza, Salomon. He hasn't got long. Lima stared at her for a moment in silence. Lanza, too. Last night. A policeman was standing at Lima's side. You'll have to move away from here, he said. It's forbidden to obstruct the crossing point. Lima's half turned. Go to hell, he snapped. The German stiffened, but the woman said, get in. We'll drive down to the corner. He got in beside her and they moved slowly down the road to a side turning. I didn't know you had a car, Lima said. It's my husband's, she replied indifferently. Carl never told him I was married, did he? Lima was silent. My husband and I work for an optical firm. It had us over to the business. Carl only told you my maiden name. He didn't want me mixed up with you. Lima took a key from his pocket. You want somewhere to stay, he said. His voice sounded flat. There's an apartment in the Albert Durastrasse next to the museum, number 28. You'll find everything you want. I'll telephone you when he comes. I'll stay here with you. I'm not staying here. Go to the flat. I'll leave. There's no point in waiting here now. But he's coming to this crossing point. Lemus looked at her in surprise. He told you that? Yes. He knows one of the Vocos there, the son of his landlord. They help. That's why he chose this route.
and he told you that